Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I'm Sammy Yenigan. This week on Culturetopia, Emmy-nominated actress Amy Poehler talks to NPR's Ari Shapiro about her role as an aspiring local politician on the NBC comedy Parks and Recreation. Then Martin Lindstrom, the author of Brandwashed, explains the many tricks that companies use to manipulate our minds and persuade us to buy. And the Texas trio Girl in a Coma performs loud Latin alt-rock in both English and Spanish, though its members are only fluent in one of the two. But first,
while the overall economy in the U.S. seems to be stuck in neutral, there are a few bright spots. One of them is donations to the arts. Charitable giving was up more than 5% last year. But as NPR's Joel Rose reports, a new study cautions that much of the support goes to serve audiences that are wealthier and wider than the country as a whole.
Audiences at the Metropolitan Opera in New York cheered this year's season-opening production of Anna Bolena. Backstage, the Met has something else to be excited about, a record fundraising campaign. For the year that ended in July, the Met brought in $182 million in donations, an increase of 50% over the year before. General Manager Peter Gelb credits the Met's new initiatives, like its HD transmissions to some 1,700 movie theaters around the world.
The more we do that is new, innovative, dynamic, and culturally worthwhile, the more attractive it is to donors, whether they be foundations, corporations, or individuals.
The Met's fundraising is particularly striking, given that charitable giving to the arts dropped dramatically during the economic meltdown of 2008 and 2009. But donations to the arts are growing again at a healthy pace, according to the Giving Institute in Chicago. Peter Fissinger is on the Institute's board.
I know that the economy is still struggling, but the stock market recovered to a very significant degree in 2010. Those people who have significant assets may have returned to making major gifts to arts organizations.
But a study published earlier this month raises some thorny questions about where that money is going.
Funding for arts and culture is primarily flowing to the larger arts organizations.
Aaron Dorfman directs the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy, a watchdog group that monitors giving by foundations. Dorfman says the majority of foundation giving to the arts goes to organizations with budgets of $5 million a year or more.
Most of your museums, symphonies, opera houses, large established cultural institutions that are promoting the European canon, the audiences for those institutions continue to be predominantly upper income and white. So what it means is that this funding is not really benefiting everyone in our society.
Dorfman says he doesn't begrudge the fundraising success of big institutions like the Met.
That said, you don't hear those kinds of success stories in this economy coming from arts groups operating in communities of color or led by artists of color for the most part.
One organization that's having trouble attracting the attention of big foundations is Arts Engine, a nonprofit in New York that produces and distributes small-budget films and documentaries.
It was the day right before his wedding, and his wife and kids will have that pain in their hearts for the rest of their lives.
Arts Engine distributed the short film I Am Sean Bell about the shooting of a young African-American man in Queens through its Media That Matters program. Lauren Domino is the program manager.
Our big focus is to get our films in the classroom and to do it for free. And we couldn't do that without foundation support. We couldn't produce our DVDs to send to schools around the country. We couldn't make discussion guides to help teachers use their films in curriculum. Like, we wouldn't exist without foundation funding.
Arts Engine's director, Steve Mendelson, says that funding has been harder to find for the last few years.
I'm finding that the grants are getting smaller. We've been more successful attracting the attention of some of the smaller family foundations, but some of the largest foundations have been much more challenging.
Like the broader economic recovery, it seems that the turnaround in arts funding is neither as deep nor as even as everyone would like. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Parks and Recreation is a comedy about small-town bureaucracy. The deputy parks director of fictional Pawnee, Indiana, is Leslie Knope, played by Amy Poehler.
You know, government isn't just a boys' club anymore. Women are everywhere. It's a great time to be a woman in politics. Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, me.
That was from the show's pilot. The program is now in its fourth season, which finds Knope running for city council. She does what many real-life political candidates have already done in this election season. Knope writes a book.
I wrote it as a reference for myself, but then my campaign advisor said we should make it a big, wide release. So we had people contribute, and we added pictures, and we removed a lot of my poems and emotional ramblings and pictures of unicorns, and here it is!
Pawnee, the greatest town in America, is now in real-life bookstores. Amy Poehler recently joined us to talk about it from the set of Parks and Recreation in Studio City, California. I asked her why she's so often drawn to political humor, both on this show and when she was a cast member of Saturday Night Live.
I worked on SNL for so many years, and I started my career there at a time when people thought we could never be funny again.
Right after 9/11, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then I ended my career there playing Hillary Clinton during a race that everybody was watching during a time when the country was really paying attention to politics. So switch over to Parks and Recreation, people's interaction with government is usually not on a macro level. It's not a presidential election. It's going to the DMV. It's figuring out who's going to open up a park in their town or, you know, who do I complain to about my curbs being too high.
When the show started, President Obama was coming to office, and the country felt very positive despite the terrible things going on. Has the show had to change as the country has become so much more cynical about government in the last few years?
Well, it's interesting because we had an arc on our show where the government ran out of money.
Okay, you need to understand that just to keep this town afloat, we probably have to cut the budget of every department by 40 or 50%, okay?
Well, but Chris said that you just had to, you know, tinker with things.
Yeah, he said that because that sounds a lot better than we're going to gut it with a machete.
So the Parks Department was so low on the totem pole that everyone was afraid they were going to lose their jobs. And it was created by taking the temperature of the country and everyone all over the United States, like, realizing that opening a park or getting a playground built was a low priority, unfortunately. Everyone was trying to save their job. So, yeah, the show has changed. But people watch our show and they think it's a red state show. And then other people watch it and think it's a blue state show. And I think there's something fun about the politics of the show aren't very clear.
You know, the show often brings in national political elements of the conversation. Let's play this clip from a recent episode.
No matter what you heard, ma'am, the truth is I was born here.
If you were so born here, then where's your birth certificate?
Well, I don't carry my birth certificate around with me.
Why? Because you're hiding something? You should go back where you came from.
I am back from where I came from.
That sentence was confusing. You might as well be from China.
That's ridiculous.
Is it?
I'm from here.
Okay, so there's the birth certificate controversy in Pawnee. What do you see happening in politics now that you expect we'll be seeing in the show in the coming weeks and months?
This season, Leslie's running for office, and she has to decide how she's going to run for city council and what that means as far as placing ads, giving speeches, what kind of person she's going to have to become. And we were just talking today about Leslie making her first campaign ad, and the first one she makes is so encouraging and positive, she actually forgets to remind everyone that she's running for city council. And her advisors are like going to have to get a little bit more dirty. So there's a lot of fun with that, about getting into the mechanics of how a campaign is run on a much like smaller level.
Did you spend much time in small town America growing up?
I was raised in a very blue-collar town outside of Boston, Burlington, Massachusetts. Both my parents were public school teachers. And then I lived in Chicago for a few years and got a sense of kind of that broad-shouldered, windy, stern, Midwestern, warm slash passive-aggressive, wonderful. Every adjective I can think of.
I think
very
warm
cold,
slash passive-aggressive, yeah. Is pretty good.
Warmly passive-aggressive.
Did you ever go to Indiana as this show was in production or as you were beginning to work on it?
I did. I used to, when I used to had a job catering, I catered a wedding for the Smashing Pumpkins bassist in Indiana. And I served Billy Corgan shrimp off a tray.
That's insane.
It is. And I said to myself, 15 years later, I'm going to talk about this on NPR.
Does he know that you were his caterer now that you're famous?
He doesn't yet, but I'm hoping I can somehow get in contact with his management and get him to write a song about it.
Your parents did an adorable interview recently where they told the reporter about you as a kid. They said, she was the class secretary in high school. She loved high school. She was very organized and on committees. And I read that and I thought that could be a line directly out of Leslie's bio.
Yeah, certainly if you were to do a Venn diagram of Amy Poehler and Leslie Knope, there are a few things that you would find in the middle, and one of them is school activities and clubs. But there are a lot of things that Leslie and I do not share the same love for, like guns or camping, or Leslie finds Joe Biden attractive. I tend to maybe enjoy his politics.
Okay, so before we let you go, just a quick lightning round.
Okay, all right? I love lightning rounds.
Okay, what are you going to be for Halloween?
Nothing. I hate Halloween. I hate dressing up. I wear wigs, makeup, costumes every day. Halloween is like my least favorite holiday.
What song is on repeat on your iPod right now?
Adele.
Someone like you,
yes.
All right.
That song is off the hook good, and it makes everybody feel like they can sing it well.
If you could play anyone in a biopic, who and why?
Christy McNichol and the Christy McNichol Story.
Explain.
There's no explanation needed for that, but let me think of something that your audience would appreciate, something a little bit more erudite.
You don't have to pander to the public
audience. No, please, NPR, allow me to. I would love to play Frank Gehry.
The architect.
The architect, of course.
And finally, what's on your DVR right now?
Up All Night, my husband's show, Parks and Recreation, constantly recording Law and Order. It's still the best show ever to fall asleep to. I usually get through the order. I'm asleep by the law.
So you watch your own show every week?
Yeah.
I kind of love that you and your husband watching each other's shows together. That's really sweet.
Well, what else are we going to do? Not watch it? Wait, listen. Yeah. Any actor or actress that tells you they don't watch their stuff is lying.
What a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry. That's how I'm going to end on. Well, maybe you can edit that out.
Amy Poehler plays Leslie Knope on NBC's Parks and Recreation. And the husband she just mentioned, that would be Will Arnett, who stars in Up All Night. Every so often, a book becomes a cultural phenomenon. Sybil was one such book. It was published in 1973, billed as the true story of a woman who suffered from multiple personality disorder. It was a huge bestseller and became a popular TV movie. Now a new book, called Sybil Exposed, reveals an even stranger story of the real Sybil. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
When Sybil first came out, it not only shot to the top of the bestseller lists, it also spawned a psychiatric phenomenon. Within a few years of its publication, reported cases of multiple personality disorder leapt from less than 100 to thousands. But, says writer Debbie Nathan, most of the story is based on a lie.
Shirley started acting like she had a lot of people inside her.
Shirley is Shirley Mason, the real Sybil. She grew up in the Midwest in a strict Seventh-day Adventist family. An emotionally needy young woman, she decided to seek psychiatric help. Shirley became unusually attached to her psychiatrist, Dr. Connie Wilbur, and she knew that Dr. Wilbur had a special interest in multiple personality disorder.
And Shirley feels, after a short time, that she's not really getting the attention she needs from Dr. Wilbur. One day she walks into Dr. Wilbur's office and she says, "I'm not Shirley, I'm Peggy." And she says this in a childish voice.
Dr. Wilbur believed she had stumbled on a remarkable case. She began seeing Shirley frequently and eventually teamed up with the writer Flora Schreiber to work on a book about her patient. The two women taped a series of interviews. In this excerpt, Dr. Wilbur describes the moment that Peggy first appeared. She uses the pseudonym Sylvia to protect Shirley's identity.
She said, "I'm Peggy," and she proceeded to tell me about herself, that Sylvia couldn't stand up for herself and she had to stand up for her. Sylvia couldn't get angry because her mother wouldn't let her, but she got angry. She knew it was a sin to get angry, but people got angry, so she got angry.
Shirley became increasingly dependent on Dr. Wilbur for emotional and even financial support. She was eager to give her psychiatrist what she wanted.
Once she got this diagnosis, she started generating more and more personality. She had babies, she had little boys, she had teenage girls. She wasn't faking. I think a better way to talk about what Shirley was doing was that she was acceding to a demand that she have this problem.
Dr. Wilbur began injecting Shirley regularly with sodium pentothal, which was then being used to help people remember traumatic events that they had repressed. Under the influence of drugs and hypnosis, the very suggestible Shirley uncovered her many personalities. In this excerpt from a recording of one session, Dr. Wilbur talks to Shirley about a new personality who has surfaced.
What's your name?
I'm Shirley.
She said her name is Shirley. And she said about my grandma and...
No, she said it was her grandma. And her mother.
Is this another part of you, sweetie?
I'm thinking about it. It feels like it's sort of...
Yeah, it feels like it's sort of another part of you.
Reading through Flora Schreiber's papers, Nathan says, it becomes obvious that the writer knew that Shirley's story was not entirely true. Memories of a traumatic tonsillectomy, for instance, morphed into a lurid story of abuse. And Schreiber seemed eager to pump up or even create drama where none existed. If Schreiber had doubts, she suppressed them.
She already had a contract and she already had a deadline. She was in the middle of writing the book. So she had sort of the dilemma that, you know, all journalists have nightmares about. What if my thesis turns out to be wrong as I do my research, but it's too late?
At one point, Shirley tried to set things straight. She wrote a letter to Dr. Wilbur admitting that she had been lying. "I do not really have multiple personalities," she wrote. "I do not even have a double. I am all of them." Dr. Wilbur dismissed the letter as Shirley's attempt to avoid going deeper in her therapy. By now, says Nathan, Dr. Wilbur was too heavily invested in her patient to let her go.
She had already started giving presentations about this case. She was planning a book. She was very, very attached to the case emotionally and professionally, and I don't think she could give it up.
And what about Shirley?
She got the very, very strong impression when she went in and brought this letter of recantation to Dr. Wilbur that if she didn't go with the program, she was not going to have Dr. Wilbur anymore. And Dr. Wilbur was giving her 14, 18 hours of therapy a week. So how could you give up Dr. Wilbur?
The book succeeded beyond anyone's expectations, selling some 6 million copies around the world, and was made into a TV movie starring Sally Field. As that movie draws to a close, Joanne Woodward, as Dr. Wilbur, describes a happy ending for Sybil.
Today, Sybil lives peacefully in a small college town where she's a professor of art. There's not enough time in the day for her to do everything she wants. But that time, in every sense, is her own. She tells me she's happy. I know she's free.
Shirley Mason almost had that life, but when Sybil came out and people began to suspect it was her, she fled, moving to a home near Dr. Wilbur, living in her shadow and dependent on her psychiatrist until the end of her life. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Remember this commercial from back in the 1980s?
A Milky Way day helps you work, rest, and play.
Work, rest, and play. Well, Martin Lindstrom has worked in advertising for much of his life, helping corporations come up with new and, yes, deceptive ways for them to help sell you products. And he's written a kind of tell-all about how the industry works. The book is called Brandwashed: Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy. And according to Lindstrom, the best marketers know that the average American three-year-old can recognize at least 100 brands. But that's not all.
We even are affected by brand messages before we're born, while we're still in the womb.
How is that possible?
Well, a recent research study conducted in the UK shows that pregnant women, while they're watching a certain TV show, in fact were affecting the unborn babies. And as they were born later on, they had a strong preference for this show, where in comparison to the group which were not watching this show while the mother was pregnant, they had no effect whatsoever.
You write that the tiniest things also can make a difference in our perception of a brand, even the sound of the packaging.
Yeah, that's right. We know, for example, today that if you open a cola, the sound generated, in fact, is so powerful that it generates at an unconscious level craving. And that craving actually is so important because most people are not watching TV commercials anymore. They're listening to the commercials while they're standing in the kitchen or whatever they're doing. Because it is non-conscious, it actually affects our craving instinct. So what we noticed in this research was that a lot of brands have forgotten to put in the craving sound, and now putting it in, and not just the sound of a cola being opened or ice cubes in a glass, but also the sound of a sizzling steak, for example, is so hardwired into our behavior that in the end of the day, we simply can't stand back. We actually have to be part of that product.
You recently wrote an article, and it's also in the book, about Whole Foods. And you talk about how they make their produce more attractive.
Yes. So as you enter the Whole Foods store, you'll notice in many of their stores, they are cutting fresh flowers.
Oh, right. That's right.
And it's not a coincidence. First of all, most likely they're not earning money on it. But what they are doing is to tell you at a non-conscious level that, in fact, everything is fresh in this store. Just take the opposite. Imagine you're walking to the store and it had cans of tuna with the expiration dates of 2 years. You will immediately, at the center of the entire store, would be 2 year plus old. And as you will notice in Whole Foods in particular, they're playing a lot on the farmer's feel. You feel things come from the farmer's market.
Right.
Now, if you are very careful, you look at those boxes which are holding the apples and the bananas. And yes, they're coming from something called Patty's Farm, making us believe that Patty was just backing up her truck this morning and offloading all her bananas from the farm. Well, the story is probably very different. Those individual cardboard boxes is actually one big gigantic dummy with plastic inside, which are holding the bananas. And yes, in the backside of the store, they're offloading all those bananas from huge plastic containers, most likely flown in the day before, into those individual-looking cardboard boxes, which, by the way, is not Patty's Farm. It's actually been designed by a graphic design company in New York City to make us feel this is nostalgia at its peak.
I'm speaking with Martin Lindstrom. He's the author of a new book called Brandwashed. Martin, you actually carried out your own experiment. You hired a family to live in Laguna Beach in Southern California. You filmed them secretly, and you had them basically invite friends over from the neighborhood, and they would just casually talk about things, brands of things that they're using, like a blender or a type of car. Tell me about this experiment.
So what we did then was non-scripted, basically to ask this family to have one mission, to tell the world about 10 different brands we carefully had selected, but to make sure no one would discover why they were talking about those brands, so the hidden intent. I have to admit, I was fairly skeptical in the beginning. I thought, I wonder what we'll get out of this, but was blown away already the first week when I realized that the word of mouth is so much more powerful. And the reason why I had that sense was because I had actually tried almost a year before exactly that phenomenon on my own body. I was standing at a gas station in Australia, in Sydney, and this man comes up to me as I'm filling up my car and saying, "Hey, mate, would you like to try this type of gas?" And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, I actually have the same car as you have, and it just works so much better. I would try that if I was you." And I was not listening so much to it, but what I realized was that 2 weeks later, I actually was using that brand he was recommending, and I heard exactly that same voice. 3 months later, it was at another gas station, and that man was now not talking to me, but to another person next to him, saying exactly the same phrase, "I have the same car as you, and you should use this." And I realized this was a setup, and he was employed by this oil company in order to promote this particular brand.
Hmm.
And I realized, hey, if I can fall for this working in the industry of marketing and branding, then everyone would be falling for this. So coming back to the experiment, this simple family, they within 3 months were able to spread the word of mouth to 15,000 people.
Incredible.
Across California.
The family are the Morgansons. And I just want to play a clip of tape. This is Gina Morganson, the mother, talking about Kiss My Face lotion to some friends that are just casually visiting, and she brings this up. Let's take a listen.
I use, you know, the Kiss My Face stuff I was telling you guys about, all that peace soap and all that great soap. Well, I use all that stuff for my face now.
They have a whole facial line too?
unbelievable.
Well, I thought it was just kind of the basic. Yeah,
the smells are like you've been at a spa.
So here's the thing. That is so creepy. And I think it's creepy because we have all been in that situation. But this was being done deliberately. How effective was it?
Well, it was so effective that we know that every person which was affected by or listened into these conversations, they bought a brand. In fact, we know that 9 out of 10 definitely bought at least 1 out of the 10 brands.
Wow.
It just gave me an indication of how powerful this was. And I was pretty convinced that after 1 month, people will start to realize, hey, this is a setup.
Yeah, I mean, weren't people in the neighborhood saying, this is a little weird. This family keeps talking about all these brands every time we go to their house.
No, and do you know why? Because you and I are talking about brands 25% of our entire time.
Huh.
And not only that, when we are sitting at the dinner table, we are talking about brands 51% of the time. So it's become such a big part of our lives that I would almost claim we have nothing to say to each other if we can't talk about brands.
How do we protect ourselves? Do we have any hope?
Well, besides you switching off the television, the computer, and the iPhone and going under your duvet and just sleeping for the rest of your life, there is a couple of other pieces of advice which probably is more useful. Point number one, you need to educate your children at home. They do not know what brands are, really. They think brands is some physical stuff. But the reality is it's in our mind. And if you start to educate them about that, at a very young age, like 5 or 6 years old, they're prepared before they're going to school. So they're not a victim to this peer pressure we're seeing happening so much right now. Secondly, when you're going out shopping, there's some very simple tricks you can use. One of them is never to grab a shopping cart. Why? Well, because we know today that if I'm doubling the size of your shopping cart, you actually are buying up to 40% more. Another thing you should do is to always pay cash, because then we have a physical relationship with the money. Make sure you're never hungry. It's pretty natural. But by the way, you're also buying more clothes and more CDs and whatever if you're hungry. So there's a lot of concrete advice. But I think in the end of the day, what you have to be aware of is that this is our life and we should just not be fooled that it's not there. So that's the reason why I'm writing Brandwashed, because I think people need a wake-up call.
That's Martin Lindstrom. He's the author of the new book, Brandwashed: Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy. Martin Lindstrom, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And now a rock band that's using Spanish to grow its audience Latino style. The members of Girl in a Coma grew up listening to Selena, the late singer who had huge hits on Spanish language radio in the 90s. She sang a style of Latin pop music called Tejano. Like Selena, the members of Girl in a Coma are Mexican-Americans from Texas, and like Selena, they are English speakers who are learning Spanish by singing it. NPR's Felix Contreras has more.
Girl in a Coma is a trio of young women from San Antonio who play rock music, loud rock music. Twenty-three-year-old Nina Diaz is the main singer and songwriter and the youngest member of the band. Her sister Fanny plays drums, and their longtime friend Jen Alva plays bass. They are signed to a label owned by rocker Joan Jett. They take their name from the song Girlfriend in a Coma by the 80s rock band The Smiths. They are very much like other rock musicians working hard to make a name for themselves. They are also like many Latinos in the U.S. who don't speak Spanish. According to a national survey by the Pew Hispanic Center in Washington, D.C., 23% of adult Latinos here in the U.S. are English dominant. Nina Diaz says she often feels left out.
You know, when the grandparents are talking to the older sister or just even adult conversations, you hear them talking and it seems like such a foreign thing. And like, it's like, what are you saying? I want to understand you. But then you go off and you play with your toys and you're like, oh, whatever, you know, I guess I'll understand it later.
Diaz says she grew up very much like Selena, an English speaker who listened to English language radio and didn't pay attention in Spanish classes in school.
I wish I would have paid more attention then, because now I realize I kind of messed up. And there's times, like, especially with singing the songs in Spanish, I'm basically teaching myself how to speak Spanish by singing it. I'm doing it kind of like the Selena way.
The slain Tejano star became a musical and cultural inspiration with songs like her 1994 hit, Si Una Vez.
I would always just listen to the music. I never really understood what she was saying. So when it came to doing the song, I wrote out the lyrics, studied it, fell asleep to it, and did it as many times as I had to in the studio. And performing it live is the best way, because you get different feels for it, different vibes. It becomes your own.
Diaz says learning Spanish by singing is helping all of the musicians of Girl in a Coma communicate beyond their generation.
It's hard enough as it is, you know, being an all-girl band, two-thirds gay, all Latinas. And whenever they ask us a question in Spanish, all of us are like, can you repeat it again in English, please? I'm sorry. You know, it's a little embarrassing, I admit that. So it's also just to be able to stand up and say, I am Latina, and I know what you're saying to me, and I'm going to answer you back.
Nina Diaz says she envisions a day when Girl in a Coma might even produce an entire album in Spanish. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Michael Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I'm Sammy Yenigan. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.